and welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Sam is off this week, but I am your host today, Becky Friedman, and with me in the studio are Josh and Dan. How are you guys today?
I'm doing pretty good.
I'm doing great, Becky.
Yeah, I'm doing great too, because you know what? It is my vacation time. I have started my 2-week break from the day job of being a public school teacher. You guys aren't quite on a break yet, right?
What's a break?
What's a break?
I am.
Yeah, fellow educator, right? No public school stuff going on this week.
No field trips for a while.
But speaking of field trips, hey, Josh and I, along with some of the other folks of Ask an Atheist, we're going to be on the road this coming weekend because we will be showing up in Tri-Cities. If you want to check us out in the Tri-Cities, go ahead and join Tri-City Freethinkers. It's a pretty cool organization. We'll be out there as guests at their solstice celebration. We do know that the solstice, Dan, is it the 21st this year?
I haven't actually checked the
calendar.
The astronomical charts.
It varies, right? Yeah. It's somewhere around the 21st and 22nd usually. That darkest night of the year, darkest day of the year as well, right? Longest night, darkest day. And we'll be excited to be out there in Tri-Cities and doing a little bit of, you know, show things and then socializing with folks on the other side of the mountains, because it's not all about what's here in Tacoma and in the greater Puget Sound area. But a little bit further away from home, there was some big news going on this week, and it was big political news, and there was definitely a tinge of religiosity attached to this one, right, guys?
Tell us more, Becky.
tell us more? What more do I need to say?
No more, please.
No more, please. Well, you're in luck, Josh, because it seems that that candidate Roy Moore did in fact lose his election, but oh, wait a minute. Before even the election happened, there were some really interesting things in the run-up to the special election in Alabama, the special election for the Senate seat. And, well, there were some funny things, like Roy Moore's campaign manager. CNN's Jake Tapper interviewed Roy Moore's campaign manager, Ted Crockett, before Alabama's special election earlier this week, where Crockett seemed to encounter some surprising information about how politicians take their oath of office. Now, you guys don't hold public office, right?
No.
But you've seen how individuals take oaths, and generally they put their hand on some kind of document and then swear to uphold the Constitution and stuff like that. Josh, you took a military oath, right?
Yes, but I didn't swear on a Bible. You swear to uphold the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, but there's no Bible involved. You do have the choice of saying, so help me God, at the end, because that is deemed, I disagree with it, deemed as being irrelevant.
So and that didn't affect your ability to serve in the U.S. military,
no,
right?
No, absolutely not.
So Roy Moore's campaign manager seems to be under some false other impressions. Do you guys want to just, hear it from them directly?
Yeah, let's do that.
Judge Moore has also said that he doesn't think a Muslim member of Congress should be allowed to be in Congress. Why? Under what provision of the Constitution?
Because you have to swear on the Bible. When you are before, I had to do it. I'm an elected official, 3 terms. I had to swear on a Bible. You have to swear on a Bible to be an elected official in the United States of America. He alleges that a Muslim cannot do that ethically, swearing on the Bible.
It's like he only has a few words in his vocabulary. I mean, Mr. Crockett, you know that if you just keep repeating swear on a Bible, it's not going to make it true or factual that, you know, that's something that you have to do. And it just kind of is very astounding to us as, you know, secularists and as well-read individuals and educated citizens. Jake Tapper himself was kind of astounded as well. Let's hear his follow-up.
You don't actually have to swear on a Christian Bible. You can swear on anything, really. I don't know if you knew that. You can swear on a Jewish Bible.
Oh, no, I swore on the Bible. I've done it 3 times.
I'm sure you have. I'm sure you've picked a Bible, but the law is not that you have to swear on a Christian Bible. That is not the law. You don't know that? All right, Ted Crockett.
I know that Donald Trump did it when we made him president.
Because he's Christian and he picked it. That's what he wanted to swear in on. Ted Crockett with the Moore campaign. Good luck tonight. Thank you so much for being here. My panel will react when
Merry
we get
Christmas,
back.
Merry Christmas, Jay.
Thank you, sir.
Well, Well, instead of having Jake Tapper's panel react, let's get a few little reactions from us. What'd you guys think of that? Did you count how many seconds Mr. Crockett was just sitting there dumbfounded?
Oh, yeah, it's like 8 seconds.
Yeah, I think it's
like a bull ride.
It's pretty amazing.
he survived the bull ride in that one.
Hanging for eight.
If you have not seen the video on this, please watch the video on this.
And we'll put this in the show notes and atheist.radio on our webpage. But it really was just that video that all during those 7 seconds, that wasn't a recording error on our part. He's just sitting there dumbfounded, batting his eyelashes with the stupidest looking grin on his face. And I really think that he is, for the first time, encountering this as new and surprising information. Yeah. Because if you're trying to spin something, if you're trying to say, no, obviously you have to do this, he would have had some other things. He would have had gone back to some tired old, you know, argument about, you know, Christian founding fathers and things like that. But I think that he really honestly did not know that you did not have to use a Christian Bible when swearing and taking an oath of office.
Yeah, this is why precedence matters. I mean, he understood that the Bible was basically over the Constitution because that's what he's been told forever. I mean, he even said 3 times he swore over the Bible. This is why precedents matter. This is why we need to actually fight precedents such as this.
And did you hear his little weaponized goodbye at the very end there, guys? Did you catch that one?
Oh, yes. Merry Christmas, Becky.
Yes. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
when all else fails and you can't any longer repeat swear on the Bible, just throw in a weaponized Merry Christmas in there.
I think it's sort of comical, the idea of it being weaponized. I know that I don't speak for all atheists in this, but if somebody wishes me a Merry Christmas, I generally interpret that as wishing me good tidings for the season. And clearly they celebrate Christmas, so I'm probably going to say Merry Christmas back.
I have a little bit of a different perspective having grown up non-Christian and having grown up somewhat observantly Jewish and having many, many people over and over say Merry Christmas, being ignorant of the fact that there is a plurality of individuals and religious beliefs and perspectives on religion in our United States. Now, I've eased up on that, you know, being an adult now. But as a teenager and as a kid, it did feel exclusionary. Now, am I going to say that I think that we should outlaw saying Merry Christmas in order to help, you know, a 12-year-old not feel excluded? Maybe that's not the biggest thing to address to help, you know, support 12-year-olds in their emotional development. But I do think that it's quite nice to say Happy Holidays, to say we you know, wish that you have a really wonderful, healthy, restful break, right? And that's what I got on Friday when I left work. Have a wonderful, well-deserved vacation. Have a break. That's, you know, good family, you know, gatherings and safe travels and things like that.
Yeah, when I was a Christian, I always understood it as actually better just to say Happy Holidays because, I mean, there's so much that happens around that time. I mean, it's Thanksgiving just happened. We're at Christmas break. You got 2 weeks off and you got New Year's coming up and there's all kinds of different religions and ideologies that actually have times to celebrate that time. You have Hanukkah, you have
Solstice,
absolutely. And then you have Happy Festivus for the rest of us.
Yeah.
Do you celebrate Festivus? Do you do airings of grievances and feats of strength and things like that?
I'm tempted to. I've always wanted to do it. I wanted to do the PBR Tower
I think it's a feat of strength to be able to sit dumbfounded and silent for 7.5 seconds on CNN, grasping for a swear on the Bible.
Followed by an airing of grievances and the Merry Christmas.
Yes. So there was some other things that were leading up to the election that were kind of troublesome, not just because of lacking understanding of civics, of basic civics, but also addressing what some people, some opponents of Roy Moore, have taken issue with in terms of his ability to serve a pluralistic society and the people represent the people of Alabama or represent the people of the United States. You know, and if he's got his campaign manager being his mouthpiece saying that a Muslim shouldn't hold public office, that's kind of problematic. That's really problematic. You can hold whatever beliefs you want about the validity of Islam, but to say that someone who is Muslim should be barred just on account of their religious beliefs from holding public office, that's unconstitutional. There's no constitutional test. There's no religious test for serving public office. And I think that's incredibly problematic. So the Moors have faced some criticism on their ability to truly represent and relate to people that are slightly different from themselves, be it Muslim or, I don't know, maybe a different skin color, maybe a non-Muslim different religion. And do you guys want to hear what Ms. Kayla Moore said
about
this?
Do I ever?
This was Kayla Moore trying to indemnify her family and her husband against racism charges and anti-Semitism charges by mentioning, well, let's just hear who she mentions.
Fake news would also have you think that my husband doesn't support the black community. Thank you. Yet my husband...
Now, just a moment. I really am kind of terrified that that person in the background might be cheering, lacking supporting the black community.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Kind of what it sounded
like.
The
whole room is quiet except for that one or two people. It's just chat. Yeah.
So are they celebrating saying that news is fake? Are they celebrating charges that you don't support the black community? I'm really not sure, and it's kind of terrifying. Let's continue.
Appointed the very first black marshal to the Alabama Supreme Court. Mr. Willie James. When he first took office as Chief Justice many years ago, he brought with him three people from Etowah County. Two were black, and one of them is here tonight.
So you've got that, you know, really old, tired, you know, piece of doggerel of saying, I'm not racist. One of my best friends is black. And not only did Kayla Moore say, hey, we buddied up with someone, but we have him right here on display.
Right.
The connection to white folks of power putting on display black bodies is just so palpable here. I don't know if it is for anyone else, but maybe it's just because I've been listening to this over and over again, trying to analyze how you thought that that was a politically good idea, Ms. Moore.
But wait,
I guess
there's
she knows
more.
Her audience.
She might know her audience. There is more, Josh?
Yes, there is.
Oh, goodness.
Fake news would tell you that we don't care for Jews. I tell you all this because I've seen it all, so I just want to set the record straight while they're here. One of our attorneys is a Jew.
I was astounded that she would say this. Now, how does this end up sounding to you guys?
To me, I think there's a big difference between using someone's race or religion as an adjective versus using their race or religion as a noun. So I would say if I were, for instance, talking about Becky, I would say my friend Becky is raised Jewish. I would not say Becky is a Jew any more than I would say that another friend of mine is black. I would not say he is a black. That is not an okay way to talk about people.
Are you friends with the gays? Are you friends with a cripple? I mean, we've gotten away. We understand that we don't use these kinds of things as the defining, you know, factor of other people. We say, hey, this is a person who uses a wheelchair. We say, this is my friend who is LGBTQ or who is, you know, married to his husband or, you know, something like that. You don't say a gay or a black or a Jew. It's this. It's like when I hear. And I've been trained to be listening for this as someone who, you know, occasionally would have to interact in circles where maybe you, based on your heritage, are not the safest. You're not going to be treated the best. And when you hear someone that's not part of the community and not linked in say a Jew, it's a dog whistle. It's a red flag word that says, this is someone who is othering you and probably for not very good reasons.
Also, there's a little bit of like laughter after that. And this is a stereotype that I guess I wasn't very familiar with or exposed to. But Becky, do you want to elaborate on this a little bit?
Well, the attorney, right?
Yes.
So there's a thing that isn't it a funny thing that all lawyers are Jewish? Of course our lawyer's Jewish. I mean, she might as well just said Jewish people are only good for a few professions. And you know, we joked within our own religious community that why do you think there's so many Jewish lawyers? Well, for a great long time, you had many professions that were closed off to people of other, you know, religions and cultures and races. And embedded within the culture of Judaism actually is the practice of close reading of text and finding loopholes. Like, it's kind of
like, I mean, putting a string around the neighborhood.
Right. I mean, we've talked about this on the show before.
Definitely.
Orthodox, very observant Jewish folks are very good at finding loopholes to comply with the letter of the law, with the law in this case being the Torah, the five books. But maybe perhaps not the spirit of the law. And that is an internal struggle within the Jewish community itself as well. But to have someone who is so markedly outside that community say, ha ha ha, isn't this funny? The media is saying that we might have had, you know, run-ins and you know, spoken badly of Jewish folks. But that's completely false because we employ someone. Again, it's putting on display the people that you deem to have ownership over, right?
Right.
It's just, you're not even friends with that Jewish lawyer there. You're just literally employing him.
Yeah, they're just somebody useful to you for a couple things, doing your legal work and being a token.
Right. Exactly. And it was so, so surprising. And for someone who purports to be incredibly pious, it was... You know, it was troubling. Not you know, the least of which was troubling in terms of his someone who purports to be super pious and yet carried on pursuing teenage girls when he was, you know, well into his 30s.
The funny thing is I don't think in the outside circles that anything anti-Jewish was actually coming out until this came out.
Well, I hadn't heard of it. It didn't seem to be the worst of all of the allegations against Moore for certain. I mean, we know that he's twice disgraced as a Supreme Court judge for trying to make his religion dominant with a Ten Commandments monument, and for trying to bar gay folks from getting married in Alabama, or as he might say, the gays, for getting married in Alabama, despite it being federal law, federal precedent there. You know what, though? He lost his campaign. He lost his campaign, but he's not giving up. Did you guys know this? He hasn't conceded yet.
I had heard.
He's still fundraising it, so it's still useful for him.
He is. So, disgraced former judge, one-time Senate candidate. We hope he's not another time Senate candidate. He's still refusing to concede the Alabama special election. He insists that his campaign would wait until the Secretary of State certified the results. And Josh, you looked it up. When does the Secretary of State, when is that expected to happen?
No earlier than December 26th and... no later than January 3rd.
Okay, so sometime about, you know, a week or two from now, we should see these results that actually, you know, solidify that Roy Moore, you're done. You know, you're a washout. Go away. So he encouraged his supporters, though, to wait until military and provisional ballots were counted. He also email blasted his supporters with a request that they donate $75,000 to his campaign to investigate some alleged voter fraud. Seems like it's really reaching at this point. He lost the election, as we all know at this point, to Doug Jones, who won by nearly 1.5%, which is outside the margin of error for triggering an automatic recount in the state of Alabama.
So if this had been, say, less than 1%, there may have been cause for a recount.
I believe in Alabama for this race, it was 0.5% that would have been required.
Okay, so if it had been 0.5% or less of a difference between the votes, then they would have had an automatic recount.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So right after, you know, most of the news agencies called it for Doug Jones, for the Democratic candidate, the watch party, you know, zoomed in on Roy Moore's watch party. And he came up to the podium and we believed that he was going to concede. Instead, this is what we got.
We also know that God is always in control. In Psalm 40, I waited patiently for the Lord. That's what we've got to do. And he inclined to me and heard my cry and brought us up also out of a horrible pit, out of miry clay, and set my feet on a rock and established my goings and put a new song in our mouth, even praise unto our God. Many shall see it.
I'm getting a little tired just listening to all this preaching. I don't know about you guys, but we'll see.
If you will. And that's what we've got to do, is wait on God. But the votes are still coming in, and we're looking at that. May God bless you as you go on. May he give you a safe journey. and thank you for coming tonight. It's not over, and it's going to take some time. Thank you.
So I guess God is the Secretary of State, and we're going to wait until after his kid's birthday to get the answer? Is that what he's implying?
I guess so.
Sounds like that position's a little beneath him.
The Secretary of State of Alabama. Well, I don't know. God works in mysterious ways. So we've been told.
The gap got so small, that's where he ended up.
Well, that was Bruno, right? When he was saying, you know, your God is too small. This is probably what he meant.
So there's some other things, though. This clearly was his non-concession speech, which he said, I'm not conceding because God's in control. If he really believed that God's in control, he wouldn't have sent tons of voters to vote against you, which we as atheists obviously don't believe that, you know, God was sending anyone to the polls. It was the, you know, footwork of concerted people to, you know, not vote a disgraced, you know, child molesting or alleged child molesting a religious bully into office. But here's the thing. In further speeches, you just see how scarily religious Moore is. He's like, he's giving end time sermons. There's these, you know, other quotes that he has in further follow up speeches, where he says that we are indeed in a struggle to preserve our republic, our civilization, and our religion, and to set free a suffering humanity, and the battle rages on. If you want to set free suffering, is there any better thing than religious war?
It depends on who suffers.
I guess, right. According to him, right? He believes that the heart and soul of our country is at stake. And he's lamenting that we no longer recognize the universal truth, that God is the author of our life and liberty. I mean, this is standard, Christian dominionist rhetoric, that all of this stuff that's enshrined in our Constitution doesn't actually come from persons. It doesn't come from any founders. It doesn't come from the concerted work of, you know, different representatives from a series of colonies, you know, to try and compromise and make a pluralistic society. No, not according to Roy Moore. It all comes from God. He says that abortion and sodomy and materialism have taken the place of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. He laments that we've stopped prayer in our schools. Well, yes, because
Wait, we did?
The Constitution stops schools from actively praying, but any kid is allowed to pray of their own accord. That's okay. Nobody is stopping your kid from having a Bible in school.
So we have in no way, shape, or form actually stopped prayer in schools.
No. I do believe materialism has taken over that. No.
I mean, there is an awful lot of materialism at this time of year, but that's a...
Right. That's a... Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas, Jake Tapper. He laments that we've redefined marriage, destroying the basis of family, which is the building block of our country. Is family the building block of our country? I thought that your Bible was the building block of your country. I don't know. And recognize, this is the greatest one, because he, of course, is well on record of being against LGBTQ folks. But this seems to be kind of a new thing for him. He doesn't want, you know, two women to be able to get married, two men to be able to get married. We have redefined marriage and destroyed the basis of family. We've even begun to recognize the right of a man to claim to be a woman and vice versa. Yeah, cool. Cool beans. Yeah, I think that we recognize, I would change that wording a little bit. We recognize the right of a human to self-determine how they want to be considered and presented in terms of gender. So I'm okay with that one, Roy Moore. Broken clock is right twice a day, I guess. we've become slaves to the tyranny of judges. Funny, coming from a
judge.
And all because immorality sweeps over our land. Man, Roy Moore. But here's the thing, guys. Yes, I think that we're close to establishing a moratorium on lamenting anything of Roy Moore or Kayla Moore's or his Mr. Crockett's, idiocy or things like that. But there is really one thing that I truly believed pushed Doug Jones over the line into victory. It wasn't Roy Moore being prejudiced against black folks. It wasn't his misapplication of the Constitution in the state of Alabama or the federal Constitution in terms of letting gay people be able to get married. It wasn't his wife's haughty glare while naming her employee as evidence for why they can't be anti-Semites. Do you guys know what pushed Doug Jones? It wasn't the black folks coming out to, like, you know, support overwhelmingly the Democratic candidate. It was horse Twitter. And for that,
Horse Twitter?
We will bring in Sam. I did say that he was off this week, but we have a special segment from Sam and our equine correspondent, Christy.
Thank you, Becky. Well, as you may have noticed this week, Roy Moore lost. Right. Okay. So, yeah, so he lost. But, you know, while he was in the process of losing, and perhaps part of the reasons why he lost was how, well, he took a horse. He rode a horse. I guess not took a horse. I'm not a horse person. Full disclosure, I know not a darn thing about horses, despite some early experience with them.
If he took a horse, I don't think it would have been televised.
Well, I do live here, don't I? So joining me is Ask an Atheist with Sam Olvey's horse correspondent, Christy. How are you?
Hi.
Not only our horse correspondent, but my closely guarded non-show friend for many years. I don't know if you knew this. I don't know if I ever told you, but I could just talk about stuff with Christy. I don't have to, like, do business or anything like that.
Is that why I'm never on the show?
That was why you were never on the show.
Okay. And, I feel kind of better now that I know that there was a reason.
Yeah. I can't say that it was a intentional decision, but you were my friend, and I never had to ask you for like segments or, you know, time commitments or anything like that.
No, you just asked me for lemon bars.
Yeah, I just asked for lemon bars. And and that was that. So this is my way. I'm explaining the situation. But now the seal has been broken and you're just like everybody else.
Oh,
so
wow.
No. I listened to the episode you were on and I thought you did a fantastic job, as I suspected you would. But that's besides the point. Other than being a member of our wonderful community and a friend of mine, you are also an expert on horses, some specific type of horsing.
Well, I've been involved in horses and riding since I was probably about 5. I mostly focus on sort of beginning level mixed discipline. It's the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
We don't really have a very strong, deep equestrian community here like you do down in California or on the East Coast. We don't have that deep tradition of it, but we do still have our horse community in the area, and it's a kind of a unique one in the world of horses, and so that's, I do that.
So what we saw this week was, the way I saw it, and apparently the way most people saw it, was still photos, apparently from the AP or somebody else, of him on his horse, and you can't make this up, Sassy.
It's a very, very good name for that kind of horse, by the way.
And then it's like, okay, that looked really uncomfortable. And then horse Twitter went wild. And the first question all of my friends had was, there's a horse Twitter?
Of course there's a horse Twitter.
Are you
We're all around the world. This is a multi-billion-dollar sport. Of course there's a horse Twitter.
Very good. Are you a member of horse Twitter?
I'm not a member of Twitter at all in general right now, although I'm thinking about starting a Twitter channel for my cat, but that's different.
Fair enough. So the first thing we heard is that he was riding a gated horse.
Yep.
Many, many horse folk. Is there a better name? Equestrians, I suppose.
Yeah, horse people, equestrians,
horse people.
Whatever.
Okay.
I mean,
all right. I don't want
so many different terms.
I don't want to accidentally slur. Well, he was riding a gated horse, so that leads to the first question: the heck is a gated horse?
Okay, so there are generally two kinds of ways that horses by breed will move. There's diagonally gated, and there's laterally gated. Diagonally gated is the most common one that you see, and that's generally just referred to as, you know, a horse.
Mm-hmm.
So like your thoroughbreds on the racetrack, the Budweiser Clydesdales, this is a really good time of year to bring up that mental image. And that's that, what's called a hard trot is their secondary gait, that mm-hmm. 1-2 when you think of like jingle bells, the horse pulling the sleigh and the jingle bells chiming, ching, 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 ching.
Right.
And that's a hard trot. And that is the majority of horses have a hard trot as their secondary gait. Then we have what's called gated horses, and that's a whole classification of several different breeds that exhibit a different intermediary gait other than the hard trot.
Okay, so we're talking about gait as a method of locomotion, yes. Not like some type of harness, which is what my initial thought was.
No, okay. It's not harness, although in harness racing, they use gated horses.
Got it! Okay, that's
slightly a general way of stating it. There are hard trotters that do harness racing.
Okay.
But pacers are gated horses.
Okay, so a gated horse in this case is the type of horse that he was riding. It was one that would ambulate in this particular way.
In this particular way, or gated horses, there are, probably about 20 or so different kinds of intermediate gait if you really want to get into all the weird little details and specific types of gates all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
But it looked like he was riding a spotted saddle horse or Tennessee Walker of some sort. It's really hard to tell with horses to a certain degree because, well, they're not like dogs.
Right.
A lot of the breeds look a lot like each other until you really get nitpicky, and it's hard to do that with the kind of footage that we had available.
Right. So this is more of a something I observed. I didn't watch the video until I watched it with you just a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. And neither had I.
We cogitated on it. Why did he look like a G.I. Joe figure mounted on a toy motorcycle? It looked like he couldn't move his legs in any meaningful way.
There's probably a couple of reasons for that. That is actually a style of riding that's called a motorcycle seat. It fell out of favor probably about 30 years ago or so. It's, how should I put this? It's a way of riding a horse that puts a lot less strain on your knees.
Right.
So in older people who are also the more likely to ride a gated horse, because the reason they ride them is because they're smooth.
Okay.
And they don't bounce you around the way a hard-trotting horse will. The motorcycle seat takes a lot of strain and pressure off of the knees. So if he has stiff knees, like a lot of Americans, especially at that age, do, that's really not that surprising that he would ride like that.
So it's likely because he's got stiff knees, he may have used this motorcycle seat back 30 years ago.
That's entirely possible.
So not because he has been thrown from a horse. That was something we discovered in research.
Yeah, but that broke his ribs. That wouldn't really have too big of an impact, I think, on where he puts his leg. It could, but I think it has more to do with his knees and probably just habit.
Okay. And then in the video as well, it looked like a couple of times he just didn't, it looked like sometimes he was sort of helping the horse decide where to go, and other times the horse was deciding where to go. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I would say that was accurate.
Is that necessarily a problem in this case?
No, it looked to me like he's someone who does a lot of riding in open spaces and fields and sort of trail riding where you kind of point the horse in the general direction that you're aiming for and have fun.
Right.
So he's not doing like arena riding or dressage where you're telling the horse pretty much exactly where you want each foot to go.
Okay. So
that's not really the goal of what he's doing there. He's kind of just point and shoot.
that's a pretty good way of putting it.
It really is fairly accurate.
The fact that the horse decided to take a couple detours isn't really a big deal in this situation.
Not really. And it looked like the horse was not too interested in approaching this giant swarm of reporters that was there. So that makes sense to me.
And that brings it to the sort of the central theme, I thought, of our conversations about this, which is when you looked at the video, you decided this whole shebang was about the horses, or was about the horse and the interaction between the horse and this enormous presser.
Yeah, the giant circle of press.
Right.
That was really my interpretation of it, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of people are like, oh, he clearly doesn't know what he's doing. I'm like, nah, he doesn't look like someone who's accustomed to riding a horse into a situation where the horse is very uncomfortable.
Okay.
And this horse was clearly very uncomfortable in this situation with all these reporters. And it was also pretty clear to me watching that the reporters themselves didn't really know horses and how to act around horses. So they were making the situation worse and not realizing it.
You mean like staying where the horse can see you?
Like crowding around the horse.
Right.
Because horses, as I told you earlier in our conversation, they're naturally claustrophobic. They're a prey animal. So all these strange people holding these weird boxy things that are, they're pushing at the rider and therefore at the horse, they're all crowding around this horse, and this horse is just trying to get away. And because they're all around it, there is no escape path other than to go through them.
And that became sort of the nature of our disagreement, is because you were analyzing the horse riding, the horse situation, as somebody who understands horses. And that's cool. And I kept trying to find, trying to find my entry point into this conversation, because I don't really feel like I have one. And that's, I mean, if you look for Republicans on horses on Google, you will find
a Google search.
I'm pretty sure it is. I found one accidentally while I was researching this story. That literally every major Republican politician at some point is on a horse. And it's just a thing that they do. I imagine it's something to separate, to show them that they are of the people and not those arugula eating city people. You know what I mean? It's like,
does this mean that somewhere we might have Trump on a horse?
Oh, boy. You see, Trump has never tried not to be.
I can't really imagine that, honestly.
Yeah. So, you know, part of it is looking like I'm a man of the people. Part of it is I think, a show of leadership. Like, he's trying to say, like, look, I understand leadership. I understand, I understand what it is to be an American.
Going back to Roy, or are we still talking about our president?
No, we're talking about Morgan. I'm like, this looks kind of silly. It seems like somebody with proper decision-making powers, somebody who is capable of making decisions like, you know, women being people, or something like that, would go, you know, maybe not let the horse go into the middle of a crowd of people who might not know what the heck is going on with a horse.
Yeah, that definitely wasn't the best decision. Also, the crowd was around the horse when he got on to leave. So I think he should have had some better crowd control to keep the reporters from surrounding the horse.
Okay.
I don't think he led the horse into the mass. I think the mass followed him to the horse and then did a surround on him.
Okay.
But I do think that he was trying to show off for the cameras.
Right.
And he really shouldn't have brought that horse into that situation to start with.
Okay. So the ultimate point here is that the horse wasn't being tortured. It wasn't like a rein problem. Because I was reading things of people saying, like, he didn't properly put a, what's the middle thing, the bit?
The bit?
Yeah. I saw, like, oh, that, the, you know, he's totally doing that improperly. And then the still photo we saw.
Yes, that still photo was not very good.
It looked like he was holding the reins, like, 6 feet away from the horse, which is theoretically impossible given how tall the guy is, but it looked like he was really yanking on that that guy.
Well, yes and no. He had a very long rein to start with, so he had to move his hand very far to make contact with the horse's mouth.
Yeah.
And yeah, he should have shortened his reins a bit, but looked like he was used to riding with a longer rein, so he wasn't really thinking about it that way.
Okay.
I mean, I look at this as someone who's seen a lot of backyard riders and casual riders, and it's fairly clear to me that he's a pretty casual kind of rider.
Okay.
As an equestrian who deals with casual riders, I don't expect him to know exactly what he should do in every situation, other than he probably should have thought a little bit more carefully about bringing the horse into that situation to start with.
Right.
And it's hard to tell from the video and the stills whether or not the bridle and the bit and the curb chain and all that equipment is properly adjusted.
Okay.
But the horse does not have a noseband, which means it's very easy for it to open its mouth when pulled on. And that alone can make any sort of contact look way worse than it is.
I also have a theory, and there's really no way for us to know this for sure either, but Roy Moore and company have he's very antagonistic towards the press, because the press accurately reports things about him. Yeah, it's weird. And it seems like that using the horse is an opportunity for him to set sort of a level of antagonism towards the press. And I suspect that's why he may have set it up to, like, basically spook the horse. I kind of wonder, from a tactical position, was he intentionally doing this, doing that to the horse to get the press away from him?
Do you think he plans out tactically that far?
I think he's that mean.
Fair. It's in one of those positions where it's possible.
Okay.
It's not the first thing that pops into my mind. I do think he was honestly concerned for the horse's welfare there. You know, they talk about how, like, you know, Hitler loved his dogs.
Sure.
Even horrible people can love and really care for their animals.
I didn't say it. I just want it known that I didn't say it. Not me. So ultimately, Roy Moore is a kid-touching, misogynist, paleolithic homophobe who shouldn't run a lemonade stand, let alone a state or a country.
Agreed.
But he's not likely torturing the horse.
I don't think so. I think he was honestly upset at the reporters for upsetting his horse.
Okay. And that's why we're skeptical. Sometimes we see stories like that and I go, is there really a there?
Well, I was going to say, I've heard that tone in his voice in my own at times when people have been crowding my horses and they don't know what they're doing. And it's like, get away from my horse.
Fair enough. Thank you very much, Christy.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Back to you, Becky.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. I'm your host for today, Becky Friedman, and Josh and Dan are with me in the studio. You can give us a voicemail at 844-SKEPTIC or find us at atheist.radio. We as atheists aren't just about, you know, saying that, hey, you know, we don't, you know, have a God belief, but we also, as atheists and as secular humanists, are dedicated to using science to answer questions of the world around us. And we hew closely to those kinds of things, and especially with regards to public health and our medical safety and our health safety of our community, which makes this story all the more concerning. I don't know if you guys have heard about this, but the Washington Post reported on Friday that CDC policy analysts have been instructed not to use the following 7 phrases in budget documents: fetus, diversity, entitlement, vulnerable, transgender, science-based, and evidence-based. A somewhat cumbersome suggested replacement for the last 2 words reads, the CDC bases its recommendations on science in consideration with community standards and wishes.
Whoa.
Some CDC officials told reporters that the language directives were not, in fact, a ban, but a strategy to garner budget approval from Republicans. A Health and Human Services spokesman stated that the agencies will continue to use the best scientific evidence available to improve the health of all Americans, and notes that Health and Human Services also strongly encourages the use of outcome and evidence data in program evaluations and budget decisions.
All right, first things first, this makes me think of George Carlin saying the 7 words that you can't say on TV or on the radio or whichever it was.
Oh, I've seen some great memes being shared around social media where with George Carlin's you know, face with here are the 7 deadly words, right?
Yeah. And second, just throwing out that evidence-based or science-based are things that might mean you don't get funding. That's chilling.
How does that make you feel as a scientist who has performed research at the university level?
It's terrifying, frankly. It's well, if we're not going with science-based or evidence-based, then what are we
going with? You know,
faith-based.
We're going with in consultation with community standards and wishes, of course.
Sure. So
what are some of the community wishes regarding, I don't know, vaccinations, like, you know, flu shots, like here in Mercer Island school communities where 25% of our kids aren't vaccinated.
Right. That kind of stuff. And even from the basis of you know, more general studies, for instance, I participated in a study on cutthroat trout populations in Lake Washington and its tributaries. And if whether or not we got funding for that research had to do with whether we went with what we'd actually discovered out in the field surveying these populations, or what the residents living around the lake thought the population should be, would completely invalidate the study itself. I mean, just from the most benign study on trout populations, even something like that has a tremendous effect on the outcome.
So I've got a question, actually. There's some folks that are saying, don't freak out. This is just about budget documents. is there any place in a budget document that would have to like reference a study? Because they're saying, you know, studies are still able to use these words. And when you're doing data gathering, go ahead, use all of these words. But is there any way that, you know, some of these studies and research documents would, you know, appear in a budget document?
Literally any one of these words can be used for something that needs to be studied. So, it's Orwellian at the least. The fact that they're trying to basically, if not outright ban a word, they're trying to change language to fit their needs.
Right. When you're writing an application for funding, you tell them what you're going to be doing, and you're very specific and detailed about it. And if you can't say the word fetus, or you can't say the word evidence-based, then you're extremely hindered in what it is you can study.
So are we not looking at studying HIV infection rates for vulnerable populations, including transgender individuals? I mean, is that what we might be looking at here?
Exactly.
Right.
This is as someone who is not only invested in using science as the best way to figure out what's going on in the world, as opposed to using faith, you know, as someone who's invested in utilizing science to ensure public safety, this is really chilling. I think that even those folks who are not atheistic, but invested in public safety and public health should be really, really scared by this kind of thing.
Not just that, but also environmental concerns. I mean, when we look at the word diversity, we usually think of different kinds of people, and that's probably what they mean and recommending against using this kind of phrasing. But if you're doing any sort of a biological survey, you look at biodiversity. You look at all of the different kinds of creatures that live in a place. And when you're doing that sort of survey, what you're usually looking for is effects or damage from human activities.
So why would this matter for CDC? Isn't this just making sure that, you know, Ebola doesn't come into the United States and cause an epidemic? I mean, how would eliminating the word diversity really affect public health? I mean, after all, it's just, you know, saying, hey, we got to shut down our ports of entry if there's people, you know, coming from countries and, you know, that might have those kinds of diseases, or, you know, screen people so that they don't transmit those illnesses to vulnerable individuals. Oh, wait a minute. Hold on a sec.
Right.
So maybe it's just about making sure that the flu shots are adequately calibrated to the yearly strains of the flu so that we can ensure that vulnerable populations like people with asthma and COPD don't get the flu. Oh, never mind. We can erase it. So all populations don't get the flu because, you know, the flu mutates and expresses a lot of diversity.
Nope.
And oh, wait a minute. Hold on a sec.
Well, don't forget Zika either.
So, Zika, right. Okay, so at least we can still have Zika funding because we need to make sure that women who choose to carry their pregnancies to terms are able to adequately protect their growing fetus. Oh, wait a minute.
No, you got to use baby.
Oh,
you have to use baby there. That's what they're going for.
So where else would I...
Well, it's in the tax plan, isn't it?
So could I use maybe certain cities that have been affected by, you know, major disasters that maybe in Puerto Rico, where we need to make sure that cholera outbreaks are really kept to a minimum, they should have slightly more funding because they might be entitled to. Oh, no entitlements?
Entitled.
Oh, okay. So this in any way does not affect any kind of, you know, outcomes for, you know, for public health and safety, does it?
No, not at all. I mean, controlling language is definitely for the benefit of
us. It is certainly not a tried and true method of control that generally leads to revolt of some kind or another. No, certainly. Absolutely, you can control, like, you know, I'm all out of sarcasm. I can't do it anymore. I'm done.
It hurts so much.
Well, if we're all out of sarcasm, I guess we'll just have to go with evidence-based data.
No.
Oh, man. Ugh. Okay. So here's the thing. I challenge everyone to, within your state public health departments, to liberally use these seven words: fetus, evidence-based, transgender, vulnerable, entitlement, diversity. What's our last one? What are we missing?
Science-based.
Yeah, there we go. Because you know what? We're seeing a lot of rejection of federal political things by states that are picking up the moral slack, right? And hopping too. So I challenge all state public health departments to liberally use these seven words.
Maybe we can also, you know, sort of use it like the way that a lot of people on the other side of the political aisle are using Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays. There may be some way to weaponize the allegedly banned language. If I see someone who has a beautiful baby and be like, hey, that's a great looking post fetus, you know, just.
Yes. And if there's multiple post fetuses, if there's multiple former fetuses in a classroom and they kind of all come from different backgrounds, we could just celebrate the diversity of those vulnerable little creatures. Right. All those wonderful little humans that are post fetus right. phase.
And as everyone knows, you would find more diversity in a public school classroom where everybody's there under an entitlement to free education. Right.
Oh, my goodness. Guys, I don't know if I can withstand such control of state media and publication and things like that. So let's go to somewhere where there's absolute freedom of press, like North Korea.
Whee!
Oh, yay.
So here's the thing. Obviously, I'm not out of sarcasm because in North Korea, North Korea's state media has asserted that Kim Jong-un can control extreme weather. The so-called dear leader allegedly ascended Jang-un Peak, the highest point atop the volcanic mountain where legend holds that Kim's father was born under a double rainbow.
All the way across the sky.
Supposedly, the younger Kim was summiting the 9,000-foot mountain through an unyielding blizzard, but caused the snow to clear and give way to, quote, charming scenery, showing magic peaks and dazzling sunshine at the peak. State media reported that it was a marvelous scene with glee at the reappearance of its great master, who was described as the man who controls nature. No word on whether Kim ranks this accomplishment, where he ranks this accomplishment in relation to having found both a cure for Ebola and a unicorn lair. Also things reported by North Korean state media.
Okay, I gotta know. Are these things related? Did the unicorn lair have anything to do with the Ebola cure?
I don't quite think so, but it may have had something to do with the cancer cure or him being able to drive a car at age 3 or hitting a hole in one on all 18.
That was his father.
Oh, it was father?
His
okay,
father did
sorry.
That.
I confuse my fictitious godlike supreme dictators.
I'm excited. I think we need to contract him out to help us with California.
Hey, right.
We could definitely use the help right now.
Yeah, if he could control the weather, he could make a lot of friends nationally and internationally by ending droughts or ending floods
or massive fires,
altering hurricanes.
It would introduce a bit of diversity of thought to vulnerable you know states like California that are quite vulnerable to a diverse array of extreme weather.
So we got to call Dennis Rodman now.
Oh my goodness!
I just unofficial ambassador to Kim Jong Un.
I just had the nightmare panic attack that Dennis Rodman was going to lead Health and Human Services next, because you know he could go with community standards and community wishes instead of evidence based and science based things. So, is there anything evidence based or science based about a dude in Korea being able to control and be the master of nature and the master of weather?
Unless he's Cobra Commander and has built that machine, probably not.
But speaking of things that are completely laughable, we've got some For Science today from Dan. What you got for us?
Thanks, Becky. Today's For Science is about the evolution of laughter. Whether it's in response to tickling, a funny situation, or even an awkward one, laughter is an unusual behavior. So what exactly is laughter? Why do we do it? And how did this behavior come about? So here's what we know. There's an old saying that starts with, "Laugh and the world laughs with you," and it appears to be accurate. People are about 30 times more likely to laugh when surrounded by other people than they are to laugh when they're alone. That in and of itself suggests that laughter must have a social function. We can also find laughter playing an important role in every human culture, and it appears to have the same stimuli and meaning, so it must also convey a significant advantage in order to have become so widespread. A 2013 study published by Gregory Bryant in the journal Evolution and Human Behavior suggests that laughter serves as a social bonding tool and can indicate the closeness of relationships. The study breaks down laughter into two kinds: spontaneous laughter, which occurs on its own as early as a few months of age in humans, and volitional laughter, which is a deliberate behavior and is learned later in childhood. Recordings were taken of both types of laughter and played back for other humans. Not surprisingly, research subjects were able to distinguish between the two types of laughter. That probably doesn't come as a shock to anyone who regularly observes social interactions at home, at work, or in other situations, Most of us can tell a fake laugh when we hear it. Why we have this ability to discern may have something to do with survival in large groups. A 2015 study by the same author supports the idea that laughter may facilitate building social bonds. Recordings of co-laughter, two people laughing at the same time, in American English were played, then listeners from 24 different societies were asked to rate the relationship between the two laughing as either friends or strangers. The listeners consistently guessed the relationships of those laughing better than random chance. So across different human societies, we can tell a fake or volitional laugh from a genuine, spontaneous one. Not only that, but we can use that information to determine the relationships of others laughing together. But a rather odd quirk came out of the first study that might tell us a bit more. When the recordings of laughter were slowed down, listeners still attributed volitional laughter to other humans. At slower speeds and lower pitch, we can still tell it's a human fake laughing. The same was not true of spontaneous laughter. Listeners were unable to distinguish slowed spontaneous laughter from slowed animal vocalizations, which brings us back to evolution. You see, we're not the only animals that laugh. Our great ape relatives share this strange behavior. A 2010 study by Marina Davila Ross examined the qualities of tickle-induced laughter in orangutans, gorillas, chimpanzees, bonobos, and humans. I'd just like to take a second to point out here that that means someone's job as a research scientist was to tickle baby gorillas. Qualities such as pitch, duration, and breathing in or out during the laughter were examined, and the findings supported the evolutionary relationships established by genetic studies. That is, that orangutans are the most distant relative of ours among the apes, and that we share a more recent common ancestor with chimps and bonobos. The simplest explanation, then, is that laughter evolved once in our primate lineage, about 10 to 16 million years ago. Orangutan laughter consists mostly of pants. Gorillas grunt and pant, chimpanzees grunt, pant, and squeal, and like us, also appear to use volitional laughter to strengthen social bonds. Bonobo laughter is louder, higher pitched, and consists of a larger range of vocalizations. While human laughter was by far the most vocally complex and occurred in more situations than those of our great ape relatives, the similarity is undeniable. But there's a little hang-up. Rats. During play, tickling, and positive social interactions, rats emit ultrasonic vocalizations of about 50 kilohertz that follow the same patterns and cues of great ape laughter. Brain imaging shows similarities in what happens in their brains and ours during laughter as well. So perhaps laughter is a more common behavior in mammals than we've observed, or maybe it's one that has evolved multiple times. Either way, laughing is something we seem to do best and most when we're together with friends, regardless of culture or even species. With our country divided and the holidays upon us, I think we could all use a good laugh right now. I'm Dan Lombardo, and this has been For Science.
If you have a scientific question or topic that you'd like to hear about on the radio or on the podcast, leave us a voicemail at 844-SKEPTIC or go to atheist.radio and click the shiny red candy-like button. Well, that's all the time we have today on Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Thank you to Josh and Dan for co-hosting with me, Becky Friedman, in the studio today. And thank you to Christy and Sam for enlightening us on equitation. Our music is by Chris Coleman and Phil Whitfield. You can email us at questions@atheist.radio. Visit our website at atheist.radio. Give us a voicemail at 844-SKEPTIC. Tweet us at AskAnAtheistWA. Find us on Facebook. Have a great solstice.